Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, tons of discarded plastic are choking off the ocean, killing wildlife, and building islands of garbage. How bad has it become, and what can be done? And then, on the Scholar Circle, facing the worst refugee crisis in human history, what can and what should be done? The ocean is awash with plastic, so much so that giant patches of discarded plastic items, toothbrushes, bottles, bags, are forming in the Pacific Ocean. Plastic pieces are killing off wildlife that swallow or get choked by them. What can be done about the mounds and mounds of plastic that is killing off our ocean life? With us is Charles Moore. He is the founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute in Long Beach and a captain in the U.S. Merchant Marine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Charles Moore. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be with you.
So you recently returned from a trip to research these garbage patches in the ocean. If you could start helping us understand what exactly these garbage patches are and how many are there.
They are fairly stable current systems in the ocean that are under high pressure cells, and they are north and south of the equator, about the latitude of terrestrial deserts. So they're what we call the subtropics. They're in between the equatorial zone, which is tropical, and the northern zone, which is arctic and cold. So this is moderate temperatures and dominated by high pressure. High pressure simply means that the weight of the atmosphere above these area is greater than in other parts of the Earth. That's because the air is heated at the equator and rises and creates these mountains of air over the mid latitudes before they condense and come down in the poles. So this mountain of air that's over these subtropical zones descends in a clockwise rotation in the northern hemisphere and in a counterclockwise rotation in the southern hemisphere. And as it descends in this gentle movement, it pulls on the surface of the ocean. So over time, it creates very stable either clockwise currents that rotate and scour the coastlines of the associated continents, or in the southern hemisphere, counterclockwise rotations that do the same thing. So basically what you have is a kind of a toilet bowl effect, I call it, where you're scouring the edges of the toilet bowl, which is the continents that release most of this debris, and bringing it into the center, which acts as a kind of a accumulator for the trash. A lot of people ask me, well, is the gyre getting bigger? No, the gyres are determined by these geostrophic forces, so it's not the gyres that are increasing in size. What's happening is that the debris that is being accumulated by these gyres is increasing, and so we're starting to see it on the periphery more and not just in the center of these garbage patches.
There are how many garbage patches now?
Five major ones, North and South Atlantic, North and South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean are the major oceanic gyres, and they cover approximately 40% of the world ocean, which if you work that out, it's close to a quarter of the Earth's surface is actually these gyres. Now, they're all remote from land, so they're not a place where, say, for instance, a recreational boater or even a commercial boater would hang out. The same forces that create a terrestrial desert are creating these oceanic deserts, and because they're in the deep ocean away from land, and they're not in, you know, Arctic areas where there's a lot of runoff and they're getting a lot of nutrients, they're nutrient poor. They're what we call depauperate. So in the same sense that a terrestrial desert is devoid of life, except for some hardy species, that's also true of these garbage patches. The only thing I would say that differentiates them from a terrestrial desert is that there's a lot of ocean juvenile species that go to these gyres because they're devoid of large predators that grow up. So small sea turtles and small mola mola, a kind of a fish without a tail that grows to an enormous size. These juveniles hang out in these gyres, these garbage patches. So the fact is that they don't have a lot of life, but the life that they do have is at a very important life stage when it's growing up there. And the fact that we're filling it up with all this plastic waste is having a devastating effect on those juvenile species.
So these gyres are really just islands of plastic garbage.
I would call them more a soup of plastic garbage, not an island. When I first discovered it in 1997, it was just a piece here and a piece there. We didn't really take research equipment out there until 1999 and trawl and get quantitative estimates of the amount of plastic in these garbage patches. So it's been 15 years since we really started measuring and monitoring. And what we do out there is unique in the world of garbage gyres, because most people don't have the wherewithal to go except for one trip on a very sporadic basis. But we've actually been back to the same 11 stations and monitored them over this 15-year period. So we have a running data set of how it's been changing, and I can tell you it's been changing dramatically for the worse. It's growing in quantity of the debris. Now, when I first went out there, people said to me, well, what is it like? Are you like an icebreaker going through, you know, plastic waste that you're just bumping out of your way? And I said, oh, no, it's nothing like that. It's just a piece here, and maybe 5 minutes later I'd see another piece. Well, you know, 10 years after that, it was about 10 pieces per minute that we would spot. So it had increased. Now, and 15 years later, in 2014, there's so much stuff there that it is like being an icebreaker. You're going through so much junk, and you can't even count how much is going by the boat. It's that much worse.
Where is it predominantly coming from? Or is this coming from everybody all over the world throwing plastic into the trash?
We always want to combat pollution by looking to find the worst and combat that first. It's just the way that resources are allocated. You allocate resources to combating the worst first. But in the case of plastic pollution, it's such a what we call a non-point source pollutant that you can't locate the worst offender. You try as you will, you can't find who's the worst, because there is no single individual source. It's not a point source, it's a non-point source. And now that even the remotest tribes and the most primitive civilizations wear polyester t-shirts that they've been given by somebody who's visited there, these polyester t-shirts are shedding thousands of fragments every time they're washed. Everybody on the planet now is a contributor. These polyester fragments have gotten so much into the seafood that the average European shellfish eater was just shown in a study to consume 11,000 synthetic fibers in their shellfish consumption each year. So these fibers are everywhere in the environment. These garbage patches accumulate the floating stuff, but the stuff that sinks to the bottom is in somewhere else. We've fundamentally changed the nature of the ocean itself into the synthetic polymer soup. And I don't think we have anywhere near the information that we need to say what the consequences of that are. But we do know for a fact that the consequences are deleterious, that millions of animals are dying, starving, being strangled, and caught by this trash. And so it's a dire scenario that is very little understood.
You said in your op-ed piece in the New York Times that plastics are the most common pollutants, but they're also as dangerous as climate change to life on Earth.
Well, what I said in my editorial was that it's a hypothesis that should be seriously tested. What happens with climate change is you get migration toward the poles, right? Things heat up at the equator and things can move. So you do lose species that can't maneuver out of the heat that's being generated and find a more temperate living space that corresponds to what they're used to. But humans can do that. Maybe a smart investment is buying real estate in northern Canada or Siberia or Patagonia or, you know, Tasmania, because we can move out of the way of some of these phenomena that are affecting the planet. But when you're caught in a net of plastic, you can't get away. It's a ghost fishing, they call it, and it's extremely destructive. And the traps that fishermen put out get lost, about 10% of them each year, and they are responsible for decimating about 10% of the target catch. So in addition to this kind of getting caught and tangled up in the stuff, there's this other phenomenon where these plastics accumulate pollutants, and they break into these bite-sized bits, and everything we found out there had bite marks on it. It's being chewed up. The ocean is a very sparse place. Animals have to swim a long way to find something to eat. So when they find anything that looks edible, they're going to sample it. And everything is getting sampled. All this trash has been completely chewed around the edges. And these bits that the animals are eating are poison pills. They're up to a million times the level of the pollutants in the surrounding seawater have been sponged up by these bits and are then transmitted through the food web. So you're getting a non-nutritive, non-digestible food mimic put into all these different species. Hundreds of species now have been identified as consuming this stuff. And so it's weakening the fitness of the marine life itself. This needs to be compared to what's happening with climate change and studied.
Let's turn to solutions. You've not been an advocate of recycling because there are some problems there. What are the problems with recycling?
Plastic is not like metal. The age of steel was characterized by a lot of recycling, all right? When replaced steel with plastic in 1979, the production of plastic in the United States outstripped production of steel. When that happened, you got a material that, in the first time in really modern human civilization, the product that defines the age of plastic, that product is not really recyclable in any major way. It has too many problems associated with it. Let me enumerate the problems. First of all, there's too many different types of plastics. You can't mix polycarbonate plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic and get a usable plastic. You can't mix polyethylene plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic or with PET plastic, polyethylene terephthalate, and get a usable material. You've got to separate them, but this is not what's done in manufacturing. In manufacturing, they're mixed together because they're used. One might be used for the cap. That's the polypropylene is the cap on most bottles. Then the bottle itself can be polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate, so it's a totally different plastic. They have to be separated. Then the labeling may be a thin sheet of plastic of another type. Then with your potato chip bags, you've got a sheet of aluminum that's been electroplated onto the plastic to keep moisture in from penetrating so the potato chips stay crisp. That's a whole another layer of problems. Or your Tetra Pak, where you're getting your milk and your soups and your juices in these cardboard packs. There's many layers there that are a nightmare to recycle. Only very few plants are equipped to even tear those things apart and try to get at recycling them. Then when you finally get the stuff separated, you've got to try to clean it, because if you don't clean it, it's not going to be purified in the remelting process. It starts melting at the boiling point of water, about 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. That's when your plastics start to melt. This is not going to vaporize greases, oils, contaminants, paints, all the things that you get rid of when you recycle steel or you recycle glass or you recycle aluminum. All those contaminants that get vaporized off and you get that clean metal substrate, that doesn't happen with plastic. So it's illegal to have food contact with recycled plastic because it doesn't get rid of bacteria. Even some nurserymen won't take pots for potted plants out of recycled plastic because they still contain viruses and bacteria that can harm the plant. So it's not purified in the remelting recycling process. So cleaning is very hard. Cleaning this stuff is very difficult because the plastic molecule is an open molecule that is very easy to suck up oily substances. That's why it's used in cleaning up oil spills. All those booms you see around oil spills are made out of plastic because plastic separates oil from water. It will suck up the oil and leave the water. Well, in sucking up the oil, it sucks up all the associated contaminants. So trying to clean that, you really have a hard time. If you've ever tried to maybe reuse a cup that you had some top ramen noodles that you did in the microwave and that little ring of chicken fat, that yellow ring, tried to wash that off with soap and water, it's a very difficult process. The stuff really sticks into the plastic matrix. So you don't purify it when you recycle it, and you have one heck of a time sorting it when you recycle it. Then you have the problem of transporting it to a recycling facility. It's like transporting air. The stuff is so light, especially when you look at the expanded polystyrene, the styrofoam kind of things. You can't make money filling a truck up with something that light. There's no weight to it. You can't get paid for your load. You've got to densify the stuff to make it denser, and that requires some centralized equipment. So it's very impossible, since it's such a universally used substance, and since it goes to every corner of the world, to get that stuff back in quantity that would give you value for your effort is impossible. So we've been created this monster, and we really don't know what to do with it.
California's legislature passed a plastic bag ban. Will this type of activity help?
Every little bit helps. We've got to build awareness that there's a problem in the first place. Most people attack things like the bottle bills and the bag bills as an attack on their convenience, as an attack on their freedom to do as they please and to have these convenient items. That's because they don't realize the serious consequences of having all this stuff blowing around in the environment. We've got to build awareness of these seriousness of the consequences of waste plastic getting into the environment by highlighting these dirty dozen, if you want to call it that, the most polluting plastic, which are the bags, the bottles, and a lot of the insulated food service things, the clamshells and the styrofoam cups and that sort of thing. You know, we have to go after the worst things first, the things that are showing up the most in our cleanups and so on. And those are the three things that are showing up. Fast food is notorious for having the stuff. We don't have trash compactors in our cars. We should, because people live in their cars. They consume food in their cars, and there's no place to put the trash. So typically the door gets open and it gets shoved. People are confronted with waste everywhere. Plastic is a space hog. It takes up more room in the landfill than anything else. Every time there's an event, the trash cans overflow because it's such a space hog. You can't really provide enough receptacles to safely contain it. It's going to be blowing around on the ground after any large public event. So there's a myriad problems with dealing with it, and banning those things that are the first ones that we see when we do our cleanups makes sense.
What are the other potential solutions?
We have to look at a revolution in design. The product must be designed with end of life in mind. We have to have a circular economy. There must be a pre-cycling premium paid by the producers of this material so that they have an incentive to design it so that it's easy to pick up. We can't just externalize forever the costs of cleaning up pollutants that we make as part of our industrial system. Our industrial system has produced miraculous change in the way humans live, but it's at the expense of the natural world. And if we want to have really that non-synthetic habitat exist for ourselves, we don't have a lot of time because we're turning the entire planet into a synthetic habitat. There are places in the world where people really never get out of a synthetic habitat and never really get to experience anything that could be considered natural. They don't care because they don't ever see the natural world as having value. The value is all part of their synthetic lifestyle. I'm very pessimistic because we're creating generations of city dwellers who don't experience any value in the things that we're screwing up with our trash. So they're not incentivized to do anything about it.
Charles Moore, I'd like to thank you for doing this research and sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you for having me today.
When we come back, the causes and solutions to the worst refugee crisis in human history. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. It's the worst refugee crisis in human history. More than 59 million people have been forcibly displaced, mostly from wars and persecution, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. And the crises appear to be worsening. What can be done to alleviate the mass suffering? Our next guests argue that only a global response will do. We're joined by Phil Orchard. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Queensland, the research director for the Asia-Pacific Center for the Responsibility to Protect, and the author of A Right to Flee, Refugees, States, and the Construction of International Cooperation. Jay Marlowe also joins us. He's a senior lecturer and an associate dean at the University of Auckland. Marlowe has published widely on the issue of refugees. David Kyle also joins us. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Davis. He's the author of Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador, and the co-editor of Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you with us. I thought we should start with the overview. We know from the mass media that we've got a huge problem. Millions of refugees, of which I think more than 350,000 have moved into Europe just in the last 7 or 8 months. Perhaps, Phil Orchard, you've just published a piece recently in The Conversation about the scope of the problem. Why don't we start with some quantification, some sense of what exactly we're dealing with refugees, asylum seekers, migrants?
Yes, what we're seeing is, of course, a huge catastrophe right now. And a lot of this is being driven by Syria, but it's not only Syria. So, of course, the Syrian civil war has produced 4 million refugees, as well as over 7 million internally displaced persons, people who remain trapped within Syria that have been displaced from their own homes. In addition, though, what we're seeing with the Mediterranean is some 500,000 people who have actually already crossed over into Greece and Turkey this year alone. But we're seeing a mix of flows there. So about 50% of the people who have crossed the Mediterranean are from Syria, but the other groups are also fleeing other conflicts. So the top three are Syria, Afghanistan, and Eritrea, where we're seeing massive human rights violations. In fact, UNHCR has said that some 80% of people crossing the Mediterranean are from the top 10 refugee-producing countries. So it's partially about Syria, but it's also about other conflicts occurring in both in the region, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and in Africa.
So the top 10, you've named three of them. What are some of the others?
Well, one of the big ones, of course, is also Nigeria, where we're seeing constant fighting due to Boko Haram. We're also seeing conflicts driven by in the Central African Republic, where there's a peacekeeping mission, in Mali, where there's a peacekeeping mission, and other such post-conflict states where there's still instability that is causing refugees to flee.
David Kyle, what would you add?
I would add that there are also a number of smaller countries that are experiencing similar problems that have been ongoing for a number of decades that are somewhat under the radar, but I'll add to the overall global demand as well. And so it's easy to kind of forget about them, but they kind of add to the overall impact and pressures put on destination countries.
David, you have been looking at this also for a very long time. How have you seen it changing over all the years that you've been studying this issue?
The general conditions are the same. States are still fairly stingy about low-skilled migrants, no matter that they're coming to work in industries that need them. They're still stingy about accepting asylum seekers and refugees, no matter how much of our national identities are built on freedom from tyranny and the offering of refuge. However, a new development, I believe, is that, and one that cuts both ways in terms of openness and generosity, is the growing realization that we're all potential migrants in ways that are not fully under our control. I think this is a relatively new thing and probably one that will continue to grow. So, for example, although Mexican migration to the United States has slowed considerably recently, more and more elderly Americans on fixed incomes facing rising food and medicine costs have also retired beyond our borders, including in places like Mexico. But I think even more potentially disruptive to current patterns and something that's kind of ongoing right now, and also eventually affecting policies, is how climate-related events may change the relative attractiveness of potential destinations. And also the fact that we must all be able to imagine ourselves being involuntarily uprooted one day.
I think we're going to get into also more of what we're seeing coming in the future, particularly with climate refugees and such too. Jay Marlowe.
I think one of the bigger contexts that we need to keep in mind is even the way that this crisis is being spoken about. And so even in your intro, you spoke about refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, and states will use those terms for very strategic reasons, partly because of what international conventions are signatory to. When they refer to them as migrants, for instance, yes, those people might be migrants, but there's almost sort of a false dichotomy between a migrant and a refugee. That yes, I was an economic migrant to New Zealand, but the situation that some people are coming from Libya, that was a country that wasn't mentioned, South Sudan, another country that wasn't mentioned, and the many others that were, that some people may not actually be a refugee. Everyone starts off as an asylum seeker. When they cross a border due to well-founded fear of persecution, they can get refugee status. But even though those that may not meet that threshold for a well-founded fear of persecution, it doesn't mean that their livelihoods have been completely destroyed and disrupted. So you take the instance of Libya. Well, yes, we can possibly call them migrants, or even the language is used as economic migrants. In Australia, for people coming by boat, they're even referred to as unlawful non-citizens. And you can suddenly see how that language can powerfully shape how a receiving society even welcomes and accepts them. So if you were to ask what are some of the changes that has occurred, I think one of the main changes that has occurred, that if we look at back kind of the refugee situation even after World War II, that refugees are largely seen as sort of an at-risk population. That has now just changed, that refugees, asylum seekers, are a risk. So they're a risk to our values, our way of life, our jobs.
I want to get more into these narratives also as we go on. And where do people find refuge when they're faced with the kinds of difficulties that they're facing? David Kyle, I remember reading in your book about the impossible situation that so many global migrants and refugees are facing. Could you give us the sense of what you were talking about when you talked about these impossible conditions?
Sure. And also, I want to point out that often these labels and statuses evolve and change quite rapidly as the journey continues and as they start to kind of go through the system. So just to kind of support that last point as well. There have always been reasons for people needing to leave their home communities, whether for trade or work or personal group crisis. And in many ways, in the era of globalization, we've celebrated this kind of mobility of everything, capital, information, goods, people. Yet for many not part of a creative class or a business elite or others, moving around the planet has only gotten more difficult. So let's start there. That hasn't changed. I think that it's eased up in some places and become more difficult in others. So it's very difficult to talk about this globally. But I want to point out that most people don't want to leave and only do so when there are multiple compelling reasons. Some are obvious and some completely invisible. So let me give you an example from Ecuador, a country like many others, with well-developed migrant smuggling networks. However, often those smuggling networks are only based in some regions, and that's because some of these regions have been experiencing problems beyond the national levels of unemployment or climate-related crises, for example. They often have some kind of unique regional disruption, or sometimes it's actually an even more of a connection to global networks. Be that as it may, even those regions don't simply empty out. If that were the case, we would have many more migrants around the world. But as an example of two cases that I'm very familiar with and have worked with, I've assisted asylum seekers from Ecuador who have been persecuted because of sexual orientation, even religion, if they belong to a sect. And recently, for example, a man who had been gang raped. And when these general conditions mixed with these personal crises and even violence, that's when most people attempt to leave at any cost. And they hope for the best. At that point, then, they're now caught in this political, legal, and cultural limbo of mixed messages and a multitude of intermediaries offering them services, often for a high fee, now caught up in a bureaucracy that often wants to do the right thing but can't quite figure out exactly how.
Jay Marlowe, this is an area you've also worked in. What have you found?
If you look at even academics, like Stephen Castles claims that this is now the age of migration. So, you know, we've sort of changed to a new era. And some people have sort of been quick to point out that human migration isn't a new phenomenon. And even those percentages have remained relatively the same as in relation to population. But if we take this in the context of sort of, you know, quite massive sort of population increases, the actual scale of people on the move is quite significant. And then on top of that, also the speed at which they can migrate. So that actually means that people are able to move in ways that they may not have been able to previously and the speeds at which they do that. On top of that, the role of the digital environment in that space. So people are actually mobile in ways that they may not even have to move, that they're actually able to connect with people in incredibly powerful ways. An example is even here in New Zealand that I know an Afghan family that leaves their Skype on all the time, and it's connected to Afghanistan, and basically Afghanistan is beamed into their room 24/7. And so it's not even, they're not connecting for the basis for the purpose of a conversation. It's actually just, they're kind of part of their everyday lives. So even though I think the way that we think that people are mobile is even changing, and that, you know, it raises some really interesting questions around sort of how we understand integration and participation and engagement with a new host society when you can actually have quite meaningful interactions with others without even having to leave your living room.
I know you worked quite a bit with South Sudanese people who had been fleeing or leaving South Sudan. What were those conditions?
South Sudan became an independent country in the 1950s and was almost immediately embroiled in a civil war that protracted for nearly four decades. South Sudan became an independent country in 2011. There's a civil war going on and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. South Sudanese are one of the world's largest diasporas, and my experience of working with them in Australia and also here in New Zealand is that, you know, that there's this balancing act with refugees and also these refugee narratives, and that there's this thing around sort of trying to balance and understand and validate and honor that experience of forced migration, that trauma story that the people have experienced. Some of you might know that story of the Lost Boys, which was a reference back to J.M. Barrie's story in Peter Pan, and basically when these proxy forces stormed the South Sudanese communities, oftentimes the young boys who were outside in the cattle camps were able to escape and made their way to Ethiopia and eventually to Kenya, where many of them had the chance to resettle in places such as the United States predominantly, but also Australia and New Zealand and others. And so that story is a really important one. But the problem is, and you can sort of see this being replicated as well in the European context, is that trauma-dominated story that's told, which again is an important one, but if that's the primary driver in terms of how we know refugees, then it's a small step to actually say that that experience of trauma makes them traumatized individuals and therefore limits their opportunities to participate in civil society. Do employers want to hire traumatized people? Do neighbors want to, you know, engage with them? And that experience of belonging is so central to that experience of successful settlement.
And yet that label and the refugee label is the very thing that sort of legally allows them to establish. Phil Orchard, you've done this enormous look all the way from the 1600s about how we've established this convention and this legal regime. How should we understand this? What is the historic context?
Yes, and that's one of the factors we have to take into account now, that when we talk about forced migration versus the group that's frequently referred to as convention refugees, people who actually fall within the convention, that the Refugee Convention is a relatively dated instrument. It's focused on the idea that states are engaging in individualized persecution against an individual, and that the individual is fleeing, being persecuted for reasons of their race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. So it's very state-focused, and we can write new things into there. So, for example, gender-based persecution or persecution based on sexual orientation. Some states have inferred that that fits within the social group category, but it's still fairly limited. It doesn't apply, for example, if you're being persecuted by non-state actors, such as rebel groups. It also doesn't apply if you're fleeing situations of generalized violence. There's simply a civil war, it's very violent, and you decide to escape. You don't necessarily fall within the convention then. Similarly, you don't even necessarily fall within the convention if you're subject to mass atrocities, because there isn't this individualized element to it. So really what we find is we've got this convention, which effectively reflects a period or moment in time where in the past 25 years, things have changed a lot. And if we look over the longer history, what we can see is sort of a common idea. And you're right, it dates back to basically the Huguenots in 1685 fleeing France, who were the first group to actually be called refugees. The first time that we saw people treated as distinct from ordinary migrants, but also people who were viewed as needing some form of legal protection when they reached their states. And that basically established this understanding of refugees that we've seen carried over since. Of course, it's dramatically changed over time, but that's where we fundamentally have this understanding of refugees emerge. And the problem is, whenever you have a convention like the Refugee Convention, which reflects a moment in time, it doesn't necessarily reflect changing issues, the changing nature of conflict, the increase in mass atrocities, and in civilian-directed violence.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the refugee crisis. So it is, in many ways, outdated.
It's not as good as it could be. And, you know, I'm careful there because I think there are a lot of states that would prefer not to have the Refugee Convention at all, or would prefer to have an even more limited Refugee Convention. It is providing a lot of protection to a lot of people, but it doesn't reflect the nature of conflict today. And similarly, it doesn't reflect one of the big drivers. I mentioned the IDP population, the internally displaced population within Syria. And over the past 20 to 25 years, what we've seen is a lot of states have adopted a range of deterrent policies and extraterritorial policies designed to actually stop asylum seekers from reaching their border where they can invoke this convention. So things like carrier sanctions, where whenever we go to an airport now, we have to show our passports. That didn't start as a security precaution. That started as a migration precaution to make sure you have that identification. And as part of these policies, which is frequently referred to almost as a containment agenda, we've seen the dramatic growth in internally displaced persons, even as the refugee numbers had remained relatively stable at around 10 million before the Syrian crisis started. So we've seen refugees remain fairly stable and then increase over the past few years, whereas internally displaced persons has just been skyrocketing and is over 40 million now.
David Kyle, let's bring you back in here. I also recall in your book about smuggling, about how there are so many structural and systemic factors that are really creating this whole industry that is mostly illegal, but works within legal conventions as well. Help us get a sense of what is going on. What are these systemic and structural factors?
I think one of the big systemic structural factors is actually cultural, which is not the way we normally think of structural factors, or sometimes what we call cultural structures or structural cultures, in the sense that the global economy continues to recover and we continue to kind of put a faith in our ability to work within markets, to go to where jobs are, to get an education, to invest in our skills and talents, often going into debt to do so. But that model has continued to be very problematic in many areas of the world. And I think that this is a systemic issue that's global, not only in traditional Sunni regions, but also now in places like the United States. Employers are continuing to their strategies of either making the workforce as flexible as possible for their own protection in this somewhat unstable time, or rapidly automating through smart technologies, which also will mean that this trend will continue. I think without reliable, solid growth and stability in the middle classes, their generosity, and this all is what kind of feeds politicians and policymakers to, you know, really consider what their political options are, means that the response is going to be quite muted, or at a minimum, a sort of wait and see attitude. I think people want to do the right thing, but the general instability and insecurity in the world today, I think, is really the big systemic issue of our time.
Jay Marlowe, would you agree?
Yeah, certainly agree with David's comment, and I guess even echoing something that a politician here said, that people are generally less generous when they themselves feel insecure. And so, you know, if you look at even sort of the debate in New Zealand around should we increase our refugee intake and that sort of thing, you get all sorts of responses about that. And part of that is, part of the reluctance to do so is partly because people feel insecure about their own livelihoods. So I think that there's something really important about that. Also, I just want to take a step back when you sort of mentioned sort of 50 million. If we kind of look at what the UNHCR says, the 2014 Global Trends, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, estimates about 59.5 people that are forced migrants. So that includes people who are asylum seekers, refugees, stateless people, and internally displaced people, and several others. And I think about 38 million of them would be internally displaced, 13.9 million refugees. And so, as Phil noted, what sort of taken that over that 10 million number is the Syria situation. And that if we sort of look at from the refugee definition, there's sort of three durable solutions for refugees that are noted, which is that they're able to integrate into their first country of asylum, that they're able to return once things settle back home or where their country of origin. And the third is resettlement. And so if we actually look at sort of the European context, a lot of that discussion that's happening is actually that around resettlement. And if you look at global numbers, I mean, generally speaking, it's a small drop in the bucket in terms of that 59.5 million people. And that if we actually look at who's hosting the world's forced migrants, it's actually oftentimes the countries that can least afford to do so. So in fact, I think about 86% of the world's forced migrants are in developing countries, countries that have very little infrastructure to support them. And so if we look at a number of sort of countries in the OECD, New Zealand, I think, is about sort of 0.3 people from refugee backgrounds per 1,000. United States would be just under one. Australia would be just over. And I think some of the Scandinavian countries might be 13 or 14. But that pales in significance when we look at Lebanon, where almost one in four people is from a refugee background. So when we kind of look at these debates that's happening in Europe, it has to be taken into a global context. And if we look at the main countries that are source countries for refugees, the UNHCR presents them on a map and colors those countries in red. So, you know, they're Afghanistan, Colombia, Syria, Iraq. The countries that have resettlement programs are the countries that oftentimes don't border those countries that are shaded in red. They're the countries that can afford to even have these conversations about quotas and that sort of thing. And so I think one of the things that we have to take into consideration is the global context in terms of where actually most of them are actually going.
There are a few things that I still keep thinking about, broader questions. Part of it is about sort of, we're talking about the insecurity that's going on, right? And part of it is, I think, cultural insecurity, and part of it is, I think, economic insecurity. And I wonder, there's just a narrative around, you know, the exploitation of the global south by the global north and how the global north sort of feeds on the global south. And I wonder if part of this big mess has at its heart the economic structure of the world now.
This is Phil Orchard. And that's certainly one of the issues we're seeing presently. Like, the numbers that we're seeing crossing the Mediterranean reflect the much larger refugee population around Syria. And, you know, we've been mentioning Lebanon and so on, where they've taken on huge numbers of refugees. Turkey has between 1.6 and 1.9 million refugees in it right now. Lebanon has 1.1 million. Jordan has, depending on which numbers you're looking at, between 600,000 and 1.3 million. These are just huge refugee populations. And what we're seeing is that the appeals by the international community, by UNHCR, by the United Nations, have been significantly undersubscribed the entire time this crisis has been going on. They've generally been getting about 50% of their funding, if not less. And so what we're seeing as part of the reason for this ongoing flight is that we've actually had decreasing assistance provided within these countries. Points that the World Food Program, for example, can spend $13 per refugee per month on assistance, that they've had to cut programs in Jordan entirely because they simply don't have the funding. And really what we're seeing is that this focus on the Mediterranean is neglecting the much larger crisis that is occurring around Syria today. But I think this also reflects a longer phenomenon and the different strategies that UNHCR has, was mentioned earlier. And one of the things we're seeing is increasingly a de facto forced solution, which is protracted refugee situations, that refugees just sit in camps for years and even decades. And that what we've seen as this process happens, that states are increasingly unwilling to take in new refugees because they already have hundreds of thousands sitting in camps. They already have huge refugee loads themselves, and they're feeling inadequately supported by the international community. And that's really, I think, what we need. We need to return to ideas of burden sharing, that we need to actually have a proper international regime, which is taking into account the massive numbers that refugees the developing countries are already taking. And as part of that conversation piece you mentioned, what I was arguing is that we actually need to think about a global solution to this crisis, that an EU solution by itself isn't removing the peril that refugees face crossing the Mediterranean. That what we actually need to do is start doing processing in the region where we're respecting refugee rights, but also ensuring that there is a valid resettlement option for refugees to move onwards once they're processed.
David Kyle?
Picking up on your last comment, I do agree that the longstanding relationship between the global north and the global south continues to play into this, even though narratives in some places have changed. We're less likely to see our longstanding historical economic connections and kind of go to a sort of crisis mentality of capacity and demand and things like that. But I think what we need to keep in mind is that this is quite confusing to those places who have essentially been told, get in the queue, do the right thing, invest in certain ways, do the belt tightening, et cetera, et cetera. And then one day you too will enjoy the fruits of development. And that has still not come to many places around the world. And that has very much been related to global north, global south relationships. And that's still very much in the mix.
Jay Marlowe.
Returning to your initial point around cultural and economic insecurity, that yes, I think those insecurities exist, but I also think that they're actually exacerbated sometimes even for political gain, and that it can force migrants aren't part of a country's voting population. They're very easy to scapegoat. It's very easy to sort of create a dichotomy of us and them. Again, that's where language comes back in. So if we're talking about people crossing the Mediterranean as migrants, it's very easy to then enter that discourse around you need to enter the queue and, you know, wait your turn, when in fact we actually know there is no such thing as a queue. And if that queue is such that less than 1% of the world's refugees will be resettled in at least the 26 countries that have current resettlement programs, there is no queue. And so, you know, elections have been won or significantly influenced. Certainly think of examples in Australia and New Zealand where that has happened. And so one of the discourses that's current here in New Zealand around should we increase the number of refugees we take is around, sometimes you hear people say, well, we have enough issues at home, or we need to address child poverty first. That's actually presenting a false decision. It's actually about a country's priorities. It's not an either or, we address child poverty or we take more refugees. It's about what priorities do we have as a country, and how do we use those resources?
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the refugee crisis. In terms of, again, you know, I've been thinking about these bigger structures, and one of them is really the nation state itself. Do we see it as outdated now, Phil Orchard?
Well, I don't think we're seeing a huge challenge being launched by refugees or migrants against the nation state. It's interesting, Captain Burn, a refugee law expert at UBC, has argued that border control is one of the few areas where the state can still exercise full control. That globalization may have taken away its ability to manage economic issues and environmental issues, but it can still block the border. And so really that this is one of the things we see, and one of the reactions I think we're seeing in the individual EU countries as they're seeing these flows through, is that they see this way as a way of sort of exercising some level of control, but also arguing to their domestic electorates that, look, we're doing something about this crisis. And unfortunately, this has led to a very bad rhetoric from Hungary, from the Czech Republic, and from other Eastern European countries, because Hungary's policies currently violate the Refugee Convention, that there's a clear obligation to not prosecute individuals who enter a country to seek asylum. They're not illegals. They can't be illegals under the Refugee Convention. And yet Hungary is acting like they are, trying to basically talk to their domestic public. And we see the same rhetoric here in Australia, the idea that these are illegals, irrespective of the fact that no one can actually point to a way in which they are illegal because they're not violating the Refugee Convention.
Australia, New Zealand, and the hostilities in this part of the world.
Yeah, so I do think it's important to note that Australia and New Zealand do have different histories in terms of working with asylum seekers and refugees. And so particularly Australia, its reputation has been sullied within the international community in terms of how it's particularly responded to asylum seekers, in terms of its policies around mandatory detention, temporary protection visas, offshore processing. And many argue that this actually violates some of its international obligations that it's signatory to. I think in some ways New Zealand is following suit. And so one of the arguments that I've made is that, you know, if we look at sort of Europe and Australia, that the perspective of asylum seekers is that it approaches towards a moral panic and it cites very powerful reactions within politicians and the general population. I think really with the exception of maybe now to a degree that New Zealand hasn't reached that level of moral panic. I've actually argued that Pope Francis made a speech at Lampedusa that he sort of spoke about this culture of indifference. And I actually argue in New Zealand that there's actually more of a culture of indifference towards asylum seekers, partly because even the number of refugees we take are far fewer. There's never been a boat to arrive on New Zealand's shores. But despite that, the current government has actually passed legislation just 2 years ago that does allow for the mandatory detention of what they call a mass arrival, which is defined as 10 people, despite the fact that the international literature shows that mandatory detention has all sorts of negative outcomes. It costs more money, health outcomes, all sorts of negative things. And really, I think part of this is actually a response that they don't want New Zealand to see as a country that's soft touch, despite the fact that New Zealand is surrounded by a lot of water and there's never been a boat to arrive yet. So it does actually suggest that there is this sort of this sentiment that, again, that asylum seekers are a risk as opposed to at risk, and that there's almost this culture of indifference. I mean, one of the things about a moral panic is that at least it gives you something to push against. Whereas a culture of indifference, it's almost like you can legislate as you like because no one's going to push against it.
Where do we go from here? David Kyle.
I think that simply learning more about the plight of people in terms of the details, both in the general trends, the general forces that we've been talking about, I think that's very important. I think learning about the diversity of people, the diversity of situations, that even in these so-called mass migrations, even among the 10 people who may or may not land on the shores of New Zealand, probably each of those 10 people will have a somewhat different story. And I think that as people learn about this and they realize that this isn't just a kind of dehumanized social phenomena, these are also people that, not unlike themselves, have the same kinds of challenges and dramas, and they're not completely rational or irrational, just like all of us. And I think just the more that we know about them, we can't do enough of that. So we talk about opening borders or closing borders or whatever, without people really having a deeper understanding of these phenomena, probably they're not going to work in either direction. And I know that sounds very easy, but I still believe that that is really the next step. And we just have not figured out exactly how to do that yet.
Phil Orchard?
I think it's very important that what we've seen in the past few weeks has been a real shift in how countries are responding to the refugee flows, particularly of Syria, but also across the Mediterranean. We've seen the European Union's plan to resettle 160,000 refugees within its own space. We've seen other governments, including the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and the United States, make commitments to also increase their own resettlement numbers. And I think this is really important because, as I mentioned earlier, we've moved away from a pattern of burden sharing within the international refugee regime. And I think increasing the number of refugees who are being resettled from the developing world demonstrates a way of re-engaging with that and of providing help to the countries that are absorbing 85% of the world's refugee population.
You know, it doesn't look like the situation will get better for the masses of people that are dealing with crises in their home countries, particularly with, you know, we all mentioned earlier, climate change and the climate refugees that will produce. So in thinking long term, that's kind of the big policy question, I think.
Yes, I think Syria is the tip of the iceberg. I think we're entering into a period in which we're going to see dramatically escalated levels of displacement, both forced migration, people fleeing from conflicts, from human rights violations, from mass atrocities, but also people fleeing from climate-related issues, from environmental problems, and also from economic issues. And what we're seeing increasingly, too, is the interlinkages between these different issues. Darfur, for example, there are still 2.5 million people internally displaced within the Darfur, as well as hundreds of thousands of refugees, even though that conflict started in 2003. But that's a conflict which, as Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has noted, had at its root environmental issues, increased desertification, and reduced water supplies, leading to patterns of movement within Darfur itself and triggering the conflict. So I think what we're seeing is a great deal of increased complexity in which forced migrants and migration generally is being driven by a lot of factors that are outside of our control.
I want to just make a final remark, and even to the comment earlier that the 1951 convention in some ways is outdated. And I think there are aspects of it that is outdated, but I also think that it's still a critically important instrument, absolutely essential. But there is an elephant in the room, which is, you know, that if the basis of a refugee is a well-founded fear of persecution, the argument at the moment is that climates don't persecute people. And so desertification, food insecurity, rising sea levels, these things aren't persecuting people, therefore it doesn't meet that definition. And in fact, you know, that's even happening today in New Zealand. Someone was just deported who tried to apply the convention as a climate change refugee. So I do think the convention is absolutely essential, but it's also about thinking beyond the convention in terms of the new context that we find ourselves. I guess I just also want to just conclude that when we talk about the Syrian crisis and how we respond to it, and so, you know, the response is sometimes in Europe and I've also heard this in the States, Australia, and New Zealand. New Zealand's also agreed to take additional Syrians. Is that, you know, they say, well, you know, we could take 10 times what we're currently taking. That still won't resolve the crisis. And my response to that is, of course, it's not going to resolve that crisis. It's going to require a number of things. But for those people that do actually have that opportunity to live a life with relative safety and security, it is actually a permanent solution for them.
David Kyle, anything you want to add?
I would just add that the era of viewing everything as a fight or flight is probably over. And what we need as well is a creative insight. And I think we're being forced into a position of looking at more creative options. And I think that's exactly what migrants are doing, or former migrants. I just got back from Oaxaca, Mexico. I was interviewing a number of people in a number of mountain towns, former migrants who were now taking care of their own forest because of various programs, but also looking into the future, and that they understand how critical it is to save their forest. And they're having to come up with lots of different creative solutions that are not even the same from village to village. And I'm not saying that I'm completely optimistic about the situation, but I just think that we are now starting, you can see the hints of a new period in which we're being forced to look at things a little bit more creatively.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle, Jay Marlowe, Phil Orchard, and David Kyle. Great to have the three of you here.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Phil Orchard, he's a senior lecturer at the University of Queensland, the research director for the Asia-Pacific Center for the Responsibility to Protect, and the author of A Right to Flee, Refugees, States, and the Construction of International Cooperation. Jay Marlowe is a senior lecturer and an associate dean at the University of Auckland. Marlowe has published widely on the issue of refugees. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Davis. He's the author of Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador, and the co-editor of Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.